When defending a biblical doctrine or practice, have you ever been accused of not caring for the lost? I've written a column in the latest issues, etc. journal titled Playing the Mission Card. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jeremy Lamont recounts his slow and sometimes painful path out of Mormonism to the Lutheran confession. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
I define wokeism, it's really quite simple. It means progressivism taken to extremes, imposed with coercion, even if it hurts the institution.
A lot of people, their worldview has been so narrowed, in large part by poor education, that the only out that they can see is a political solution rather than a cultural or rather than an individual solution that would come with having a really excellent education.
Jesus as the Good Shepherd is one of the earliest and most frequent images we see in church art, even back into the early centuries, and continuing through kind of all genres and all times.
Christ brings mankind to perfection. He is order where we are disordered. And so he brings it to its telos, to its completion. Christ himself is the truth.
Kindergarten teachers from Baltimore love listening to Issues, etc.
In his day, C.S. Lewis decried what he called men without chests. Not so much the feminization, but maybe the emasculization of Christianity. That has certainly been something going on. What role does, say, women's ordination have to do with that, presenting maybe a distorted view of the masculine in Christianity? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 4th of May. We're going to talk about masculine Christianity with Dr. Alan Carlson of the International Organization for the Family. We'll spend some time with Dr. Robert Smith of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, remembering 19th century Lutheran missionary and the second president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Friedrich Winneken. Deb Saunders joins us. She spent more than 30 years covering politics, including as a White House correspondent. We'll talk about the current state of journalism and covering the Trump White House. And then Joy Pullman of The Federalist will be our guest to discuss abortion malpractice in the state of Indiana. Dr. Alan Carlson is senior fellow at the International Organization for the Family, author of numerous books, including The American Way, Family and Community, The Shaping of America, and a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled Unshaved Masses. Dr. Carlson, welcome back.
Pleased to be with you.
Who was Cardinal George Pell?
I met him on a trip to Australia in 1995. The sponsor of the trip was the Australian Family Association. George Pell was the ecclesiastical sponsor of that organization. He was Roman Catholic. At that time, he was auxiliary bishop of Melbourne. I'd been told by people who knew him that to be prepared. He's a very large man. I mean, tall and muscular. And in fact, he was a great athlete. Back in the late 1950s, early 60s, he was played Australian rules football, which makes our American version seem pretty tame and simple. He was a great star and, in fact, had gone professional, but gave that up to become a priest, to study for the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church. I later went back. 2001, he had organized, as now Bishop of Melbourne, the John Paul II Institute for Marriage on Marriage and Family, and asked me to come and take part in the dedication of that new organization. So he was an example of what I call muscular Roman Catholicism.
There was scandal attached to the latter part of his life, but he was ultimately vindicated by the courts. Tell us about that.
Yes, the we'll call it the cultural left in Australia, which was actually quite influential in Sydney in particular, the LGBTQ movement, the gay community there has exercised a fairly large influence over Australian cultural life for about the last two decades. And they seem to have resolved that George Pell must go. In fact, the label has been for about 25 years was Get Pell. They just couldn't tolerate his form of what I'll call pro-family, masculine Christianity. And they raised issues about 2002, 2003, that he had abused a child while he was a seminarian. once the issue came to light, the whole thing dissolved. It disappeared. The person bringing the accusation said, well, I guess my memory was wrong. But then in 2018, accusations were brought forward that while he was Bishop of Melbourne, actually during a day of where he was in fact leading services at the cathedral, he abused two boys, just passing them in the hallway. Patently absurd. I mean, complete overt lies. But they were promoted and pushed, and Bell had to stand trial, and he went back. At that time, by that time, he was working in Rome, and was called back, stood trial. Again, absurd allegations, but huge mobs were gathering outside the courthouse every day, demanding his conviction. The first jury was a hung jury. The second jury, though, gave in to the mob, and he was convicted, sentenced to 6 years in prison, solitary confinement. And he was there for about a year and a half until Australia's Supreme Court, on a 7-0 decision, ruled that the conviction had been fraudulent and false. The jury had betrayed its trust, and he was let go.
So what was it about his approach that made him so many enemies on the left in Australia?
Well, one, just his example, I think, made him an obvious target. Here was a very intelligent, very athletic, very virile man defending pro-family, pro-life attitudes and views within the church. He was sharp. He understood the family issues. He understood the issues surrounding abortion, the issues surrounding marriage, and was entirely, I'll call traditional and conservative, and entirely in favor of the natural family. And that just couldn't be tolerated. He had to go. And even after he was released from prison, the sexual left sent out the new message, get Pell. And they hounded him and harassed him till the day he died.
What is masculine Protestantism?
Masculine Protestantism arose in the early 16th century, and our good old friend Martin Luther is right at the center of it. The late medieval church abuses had arisen. We could talk about those at another time in another place, but the vows of celibacy were widespread. Maybe a quarter of the adult population had taken celibate vows by then. But in most cases, or at least in many cases, the vows were not being held. There's a lot of corruption. A priest could have a mistress as long as he made a proper payment to the right bishop. Bishops could have mistresses as long as they paid a proper fee to the right pope. And it was a mess. Luther came along, and one of his foremost social cultural activities was to come up with a theology, develop a theology of marriage and family, which built on Genesis 1:28, that God's command be fruitful and multiply wasn't something just said to Adam and Eve or to Noah and his family, but in fact, those words of God were still mandatory, not just optional, but mandatory for all Christians, and that the Christian family was going to, in some ways, not supersede, but become much more important. The Christian home would be the nurturing place, the nursery for new Christians, for children, being raised by fathers who are heads of households and mothers. And Martin Luther set the model. He and his wife, Katharina, set the model of what the Protestant household was going to be. And again, it was fatherheadship was very clear. Katharina was there as his helpmate, as the mother of six natural children. They also raised four adopted children. She ran the household. Many little businesses that the Luthers had on side, a brewery, they had a farm. She was the manager of the farm. She also was the informer counselor for the women of the congregation. I mean, Dr. Luther was the pastor, but she was there to help and inspire the other women. So it was a masculine-led mission. In fact, the best book on this, Stephen Osmond's book, he was a professor at Harvard, it's called When Fathers Ruled, Family Life and Reformation Europe. It's remarkably sympathetic.
So how did women's ordination spell the end for masculine Protestantism?
Well, at the first place, it undercut the place of the virile father paternal leadership. Because, again, we, as Lutherans, we believe in the priesthood of all believers. And the home has become something of a small church. Luther certainly saw it that way, the Protestant reformers did. And father headship was a key to that. The role of pastor also had a strong element of mirroring that same structure. The pastor and the pastor's home were the model. Women's ordination said, well, none of that matters anymore. A strong, virile, masculine clergy are not necessary. In fact, we probably should get rid of it. There's a lot of harm has come with it. A lot of nastiness has come with it. Let's just get rid of it. Women can do it just as well as men. And it had the same reaction, really, to the informal role of the pastor's wife. Again, Katharina Luther had set the model for the pastor's wife. There's actually this wonderful book, which is written by a feminist, although the title is quite jarring, but it's an academic book, but it was called From Priest's Whore to Pastor's Wife, The Change in the Role of Women in the 16th Century Germany. And it kind of gets at what happened. The Lutheran family message was one of liberation. It was one of elevation of women. The late medieval church, again, had a tendency to see women as a problem. And the Lutherans quite clearly said, no, women are hugely important as spiritual leaders within the context of a male priesthood, but also within the context of the prominent role of the pastor's wife, of women as teachers, of women as mothers, as Christian mothers of a substantial family. This was something pretty remarkable.
Was the ordination of women, did it create today's transgender pioneers?
I think so. This may be a little more controversial, but the role of the pastor, of the male pastor, was spiritual. And again, it's rooted deeply in the concept of the Christian home, of the place of the Christian home, and of the structure of father, mother, as Christian leaders within the family. And this, again, was just kind of all tossed out with women's ordination. Again, I think it had a way in which there was a spiritual change, or at least a call for a spiritual change. And indeed, and again, I'm just judging to some degree on my own observations of watching a church change through the fairly massive ordination of many women, to the point actually where they have tended to displace men at this point within the more liberal Lutheran churches, such as the ELCA, women began to mimic. I'm not sure where it came from, but began to mimic the men. Somehow, even though they claimed that men and women could be equally pastoral, they felt they had to look like men and began to cut their hair short, began to suppress the, well, called the distinctive aspects of a woman's body. And adopted an approach, as I think, parallel what was going on with the women in the Roman Catholic Church, the nuns, who, after the Vatican II conclave of the mid and late 1960s, saw their role also being diminished and attacked because it had been separate and distinctively female, and that was no longer allowed. Women, the nuns, saw their status questioned, certainly the clothes they were wearing, the full habits, were being rejected. There's an odd way in which in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, women were being, in fact, the key roles of women within the Christian models of the Roman Church and the Protestant Church were equally being attacked. And again, ordination of women, I think, was a key part of that attack.
What do progressive Catholics want in their church? You have mentioned there the post-Vatican II activity.
Well, on the one hand, they want to actually follow the Protestants and allow the priests to marry. And I guess as a Protestant, you say, well, that makes good sense. That's what Luther said. Okay, but that's not all. They also want to jump ahead another 500 years or so and adopt women's ordination at the same time. The problem with that is that it throws out both models of a masculine Christianity, both the model of a Catholic, virile, masculine Catholic priesthood, actually modeled on the Jesus and his 12 apostles, an all-male group. That's always sort of been the ideal there. They're going to throw that out, but then they're also going to throw out the Lutheran alternative. They're going to throw out the male pastorate and the whole concept of the Christian home as the model of male headship and of women as sort of an updated version of the Proverbs 31 woman.
How has all of this made another alternative that is orthodoxy more attractive to many?
The Eastern Orthodox churches have what, I used to think of as a compromise that made some sense. Although I've been told by some of my Eastern Orthodox friends it's not a compromise, it's just the truth. But what they do in the Eastern Orthodox churches is they still have the head of each of the Eastern churches is called a patriarch with a capital P. That's pretty patriarchal, isn't it? And then the priesthood of all the churches, even in the Greek Orthodox Church, which is quote-unquote progressive at this point, but still is an all-male priesthood. Well, what they do, though, relative to the issue of celibacy and marriage, is that for those men who aspire to be either a monk living in a monastery of some sort, or for those who aspire to become a bishop, the equivalent of a church leader, ecclesiastical leader, celibacy remains sort of the expectation. However, they encourage those who are going to become pastors at the parish level to marry, and in fact to have a big group of children. And that, in fact, is sort of the model in the Eastern Orthodox churches. Yeah, how do I say it? It solves some problems. Luther always believed that some people, a very small percentage, a very tiny number, actually in some ways, were in fact called to true celibacy. He just felt the problem was far too many people thought they could pull it off just by taking a vow, which rarely held together. But a small percentage were given that gift. And the Eastern Orthodox Church sort of reflects that, I think even, I'd call it even the Lutheran view, that a small percentage can pull it off, and in fact, as a gift from God. And Luther would have fully agreed with that. So there's a lot of ways in which the Eastern Orthodox alternative made some sense.
Finally, with only about a minute here, how has the male beard then taken on a symbolism of its own?
The male beard has been adopted from the Eastern Orthodox practice. Most Protestant clerics and Catholic clerics in the 19th and 20th centuries avoided facial hair, but never the Orthodox. And, well, let's put it this way. Only men could produce a good facial beard, and it's coming back. I see it, as I say, in all different provinces of what we call Mere Christianity in Touchstone magazine. And I see it particularly in the Lutheran parish in which I attend. The young men are growing beards. And I think in some odd way, it's at least a broad symbol of assertion of male identity in a time when it's under assault culturally, politically, and even religiously.
Dr. Alan Carlson is senior fellow at the International Organization for the Family, author of numerous books, including The American Way, Family and Community, In the Shaping of America, and a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled Unshaved Masses. You can read it and purchase The American Way on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Carlson, thank you.
I've enjoyed it.
Robert Smith joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to be talking with him about 19th century Lutheran missionary and the second president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Friedrich Wieneken, remembered on this day, May the 4th.
This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee, San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod President Matt Harrison, and others for the 2023 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, June 16th and 17th in Chicago. issuesetc.org.
Have you ever visited Latin or South America, and while you were there, wanted to find a Lutheran church in which you could worship and receive the Lord's Supper? Did you know that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has many partner churches in Latin and South America? In the May issue of the Lutheran Witness, we walk you through a brief history of our partners in the region. Subscribe to learn more and get a copy of Made and Marked by Christ, our May issue. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe or witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, freedom, vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.